It's that time again for the EMS Educast, your internet radio show about EMS education by EMS educators for EMS educators, with our fantastic roundtable of hosts, the EMS Funky Bunch, with online educator, author, and social media addict Greg Friess, Canadian educator and author Rob Terrio, the host of the EMS Garage and the king of all EMS media, Chris Montera, and yours truly, the EMS educator from Kentucky, Buck Ferris. Tonight, episode 33 for September 30th, 2009, Teaching Airway in Kinder, Louisiana, with Kelly Grayson. Hey. That was new. Trying something new here.
Yeah, we've got intro music.
Oh, yes. Nice. We're all over it.
I felt the urge to get up and dance.
I usually dance through all our podcasts.
Okay, listen, I have enough haunting images to deal with.
Now is the time in Sprockets where we dance.
Rob, it's not like I'm wearing sequins.
Oh, thanks. Another image to deal with.
There you go. Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to the EMS Educast. And tonight we're discussing Airway with Kelly Grayson, but we're going to go around and ask everybody, the man wearing sequins and possibly nothing else, Greg Friess, how are you doing?
Hey, good evening, everybody. I always put on my finest for the EMS Educast. It's wonderful to be here. Looking forward to tonight's guests. Who a listener made this request. They said you should find Kelly Grayson and get him on the air to be part of the Educast. So in a moment, we'll hear more about him, and we'll go from there. But back to you, Buck.
Uh-huh, cool. And Rario, how you been doing, buddy?
I'm doing great. I was just mentioning earlier that I'm preparing for a medical legal lesson tomorrow, and it's painful, but otherwise I'm great.
All right.
Well, maybe. You know, yeah. I just... occasionally people ask me what – I've never been an expert witness, but people occasionally ask me what they should charge to be an expert witness. And I actually just finished writing a blog post about that a few minutes ago. So.
Oh, well, I can tell you I did some expert witness work a couple of years ago, and on the advice of a colleague, I charged $150 an hour.
Wow.
But it's a lot of work.
Yeah. I need that.
I think you could have gotten more. That's the thrust of my advice.
All right, attention to everybody. I am for hire as a professional. I don't know what you want me to witness, but for the right price, I'll look at it. I'll let you know what I think.
I've been contacted for expert witness work myself, but usually I tell them to read my blog and they don't call back.
Well, the voice you hear is Kelly Grayson, who is our guest who's fitting in right in tonight. How are you doing, sir?
Oh, I'm doing fine, Buck.
I'm doing great. Now, you're from Kinder, Louisiana, right?
I'm originally from Monroe, the northern part of the state, but I live in Kinder in southwest Louisiana now.
Oh, okay. Good. Well, as I said, you were requested, so we went around beating the bushes, and we didn't have to beat too long, and you turned up after a while, and we brought you here.
Some of that bribe money paid off.
That's good. But apparently, we've been told that your airway class is quite the thing to attend, and that you've got some interesting pointers on that. And that's one of the things, actually, that's usually a requirement for state CEUs. So instead of doing the same boring old thing all the time, we're hoping you could give us some pointers to our educators out there about how to punch up that class, make it more useful for you, more meaningful.
Well, I freely admit I plagiarize from all the best sources. So a lot of my stuff is an amalgam of things I've picked up in lectures and in clinical practice from a number of different people. But the genesis of the way I teach airway management these days came from a friend of mine, an attorney and very new paramedic named Wes Ogilvie from Austin, Texas. And he asked me one day, he said, Kelly, you know, he said, cops have a use of force continuum that, that shows them the appropriate level of force to choose for any given situation. And they're expected to go no further down that force continuum than is necessary to deal with the problem at hand. Why doesn't EMS approach airway management the same way?
Oh, that's interesting.
And that gave me that, – that was the genesis of the idea. And basically what I teach my students now and from everything from the certification, you know, ACLS courses to my EMTs and paramedic students, I teach them the airway continuum. And it's a template basically modeled on the six steps of the law enforcement use of force continuum. But it moves from basic positioning all the way to the other end of the spectrum to endotracheal intubation with all the same safeguards in mind. You know, you get to the far end of the use of force continuum where you use less than lethal or lethal force. There's usually an automatic QI process triggered and a review of the officer's actions in that event. And I think the same needs to apply to EMS airway management. Anytime you use an invasive airway, it ought to be, you know, something that's automatically flagged and QA'd to make sure it was done properly.
You know, I never thought about it that way. When I was, long ago, I was taking Bledsoe's critical care class. And when they were teaching advanced airway and RSI in particular, they kind of turn RSI that way. Go only as far as you need to go and then stop, you know.
Exactly.
If you've buggered up somebody with Versed so much that they don't mind being intubated, there might not be any reason to paralyze them.
Yeah. Exactly.
That kind of thing. So, well, was this fellow from the famous Travis County EMS? Was that where he was from?
Actually, no. He was he's a contract lawyer for the state of Texas and was a volunteer EMT in Travis County.
Oh, okay.
And now he works part-time as a medic for Harris County Emergency Services District in Houston and Harris County.
Okay.
But his main job is attorney. He wants to grow up to be a paramedic and no longer have to work as an attorney. So makes him a great guy in my book right there.
Yeah. Good luck on that paycheck getting any better though.
Yeah. And Kelly, do you have a link to the six steps that you describe?
Actually somewhere here in let me see. If you go to my personal website, kellygrayson.com, there's a link for conference resource stuff for conference attendees. And I believe there's a PDF of the PowerPoint lecture in there that people can download and use to their heart's content. And there, I also was interviewed at MSTOC back last September on the airway continuum after I'd given that lecture at MSTOC, and that video is on paramedic television.
That's great.
But it's basically, you know, the law enforcement use of force continuum is you know, it's the thing I liked about it as a model to model airway management after is it, you know, it's been proven validated time and time again in court. This is the standard by which these law enforcement officers are judged as to whether their actions were appropriate for a given situation. And it starts off with officer presence, and then you have control holds and restraint, and then chemical weapons or chemical agents, and then less than lethal force, and then lethal force. And I basically modeled the airway continuum the same way. First you have basic positioning, and then you have oxygen therapy and beta agonists, and then you move on to oral and nasal airways, and then finally supraglottic airways, and at the end of the continuum, endotracheal intubation.
Now, usually they make the cops get shot with tasers and take the OC spray. Does this mean we all have to get intubated, or what?
No. Not this. I'm a bit of an odd duck. I tested a pacemaker on myself once.
Oh, yeah? How'd that work out?
Well, I used to listen to it wasn't bad, actually. Go to some EMS conferences, and the Zoll reps will extol the virtues of their transcutaneous pacer above everyone else's. And I had one to play with, and I just wanted to see if they were actually blowing smoke. And actually, it's not all that hard to pace yourself with a Zoll, and it doesn't hurt too bad. I tell people that story and they go, you've lost your mind. Well, yeah, that's given. It comes with a career in EMS. But
well, so tell
now,
me.
Is that part of the airway continuum, the pacing part?
No. That's,
sir, let me explain this one more time. We're going to put a tube into your trachea. Do I need to turn this machine on again?
So obviously this comes in a package. There's kind of your six-step process, and you mentioned there's a automatic QA involved in here. And I guess you have this in practice at your service, I would guess.
Yes. It's not something that it's something that I do, you know, in my personal classes. Think of it as more of a conceptual tool to look at airway management rather than as a packaged course, although I do provide it that way. It's basically trying to shift the paradigm of how we actually view airway management, EMS. I know when I became a paramedic, first thing I did was I bought a T-shirt with a laryngoscopic view on the front and the logo, just tube it. And that was my mantra. You know, I tell people I can fall down a flight of stairs and accidentally intubate five people on the way down. But you'd look for, you know, the GCS less than 8, intubate. And that was my holy writ. Didn't matter if they were a nursing home patient who had been had a GCS of less than 8 for the last 15 years. If I could justify it, I did. And I think the way we traditionally train paramedics and the people we attract to EMS, action-oriented people, people that often crave an adrenaline rush, and they're very psychomotor skills oriented, and their natural reaction is not to sit back and contemplate options. It's to take swift and decisive action. And sometimes we're discovering now that swift and decisive action is actually a bad thing in some cases. One question I pose to people is it possible to negatively affect someone's outcome with a correctly placed endotracheal tube? And I think that yes, it is. You can make someone's clinical course much stormier, even if you get the tube in.
And just to echo that thought, sorry.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, just to echo that thought, I think sometimes you know, paramedics have the perception that they have a skill and they have a directive and they feel compelled to use it. Under the circumstances you described, like a GCS less than 8, because they're worried about being scrutinized after the fact if they don't. So it's, you know, we sometimes don't get that kind of leeway.
And that brings up a kind of question. Since I'm a paramedic educator, one of the things I wrestle with is, you know, with a new student who's been an EMT and they haven't been, you know, in the other seat yet, it seems like they have a problem choosing when to pull the trigger. With some patients, you know, when am I actually going to, you know, just, okay, now is the time? Now? Is it now to do it? And I try and come up with all sorts of different ways to describe that to them. And that's why I'm kind of interested in the six steps, and maybe we can discuss it like this. But one of the things I've always told my students is, well, if you're wondering about intubating your patient, try this. Give it a shot. And if you can get away with it and they can actually tolerate something that invasive, chances are it needed to be done. And
so.
Yeah, and that's kind of one of the things I tell them, but I'm interested in these six steps. How do you tell a new student who's wondering when to pull the trigger and apply these six steps to them and give them the confidence to say, yes, now's the time to do this. Yes, now's the time to go.
Well, when we outline the six steps in the continuum and go through all the different actions in each step, one of the things I stress is there are red flag conditions that justify going straight to the end of the continuum. Just as if and the ideal application of it is it's a fluid application that's subject to change according to circumstance and patient condition. There are things that we all know that you should go probably proceed directly to invasive airway management on, rapidly increasing airway edema being one of them, or the potential to lose an airway very quickly from swelling or trauma or anything like that, or inability to manage secretions, you don't have enough hands. Those kind of things would indicate that you need to right away go to endotracheal intubation and not mess with any of the prior steps. But basically, I use the continuum just to tell people, it's counterintuitive, and in EMS education, we tend to do just the opposite to our students. But I'm fond of saying, don't just do something, stand there. Because a great deal of the time, your patient's going to give you the clues that you need to make a clinical decision. And quite often, a lot of their major problems are handled by tincture of time and benign neglect. Just leave them alone. I think we do too much to patients just because we can. You know, EMS is an odd profession that we rarely identify ourselves as possessors of a specific body of knowledge, but by the fact that we have a patch and a skill set. Ask any EMT, or what is an EMT, or what is a paramedic, and 9 times out of 10, they're going to tell you what procedures they can perform. And I think that's something about our mindset that needs to change, at least where it comes to airway management. Because there are times when we pull the trigger on a tube, and even if we get it, we make the patient's course worse. The CHF patients, you know, they have a longer clinical stay. It costs the hospitals more. It's costing our healthcare system a great deal of money. When we could possibly get by with suctioning and cryo pressure or CPAP, for that matter. So it's just the main thing is I try to stress that you have a variety of options at hand, and if you limit your thinking to a specific device or procedure, you're not doing your patients a service.
Hey, Kelly, I've kind of been looking at the steps here, and you know, level 4 BLS airway adjuncts, and then level 5 the supraglottic airways, and then mm-hmm. level 6 the endotracheal intubation. Yeah. And you know, I'm sure teaching experienced providers, you probably have providers that want to just go straight from level 4 to level 6, and not consider, and then make, you know, the things like the King or the Combi tube the backup if endotracheal intubation doesn't work. Yeah. You know, how do you discuss that with experienced providers? Is my first question.
The first thing is we quantify what is experienced. You know, you've got, I'm fond of saying that there are a few paramedics out there with 20 years of experience, and there are thousands and thousands more with 1 year of experience repeated 20 times.
Right.
You know, the systems that run dual paramedic trucks and all ALS provider systems, there's a significant issue with skill rust out and degradation, because you're developing you're dividing a finite number of procedures among a fairly large pool of providers. They just don't get it. You know, the American Society of Anesthesiology says that, you know, for minimum competence, for an anesthesiologist to be declared minimally competent, that they need at least 200 successful tubes. That's 200 successful tubes in a clinically sterile, well-lit, stable environment. There's no chaos. There's no floor moving under your feet. Yet we seem in EMS to actually think that, you know, 5 tubes during your paramedic clinicals and a tube every 3 or 4 months is sufficient to keep your skills up. And it's just not. So when we say experience, one of the first things I try to do is point out that just because you think you're experienced doesn't mean that you actually are. And just because you can intubate Fred the head doesn't mean that you can't that you can actually pull the trigger and hit your target when you're dealing with a 400-pound snowman who's got a Mollen Potty 4 view and is vomiting up his collard greens and buttermilk.
Well, it's probably the same reason, though, that a lot of paramedics jump from least invasive to most invasive, is to keep that skill set up. You know, there's always that struggle to do it. And I think you're right. Sometimes people see the opportunity and think, okay, here's another chance for another tube to rack up my quota.
Well, and I was exactly the same way early in my career. I have probably, I like to think that I am more skilled at airway management, comprehensively more skilled at airway management, not just the application of a laryngoscope, now than I was 10 years ago. But in the first 5 years of my career and the last 10, I have probably intubated far fewer people than I did in the first five. After a while, I don't think anything is going to do that for you other than clinical experience. You're gonna have to see enough patients, and before you realize which ones you pull the trigger on, which ones you don't. And back to Buck's question, you know, how do you get your students to how do you get them to know when to pull the trigger? I can't really fault EMS education as it is now in at least teaching those students early on in their career when they don't have a great deal of experience to base their clinical judgment on to over-treat. You know, if you're a young medic and you're reasonably skilled at the psychomotor skill, if you're in doubt, go ahead and apply it. It's only after you develop some judgment to know whether you should whether you're more circumspect in actually applying that skill, knowing which patients can do without it.
And Kelly, do you think the environment plays a role in that decision making process? Because you know, in hospital, they work in a controlled environment. It's very easy to make a decision. With us, you know, we may be able to manage the airway by basic means, but we're also, you know, moving them and transporting them and continuing that consistent, good, basic life support care is somewhat of a challenge. Do you think that plays a role in a paramedic's decision? Yeah.
It's much easier to play the wait-and-see game in a hospital when you have a respiratory therapist and an anesthesiologist at a phone call away and a team of hands to help you. It's the decision is a lot more pressing if you're 45 minutes from a trauma center and you've got a 19-year-old volunteer fireman who's your only help to squeeze the bag. I remember quite a few times in my career where once I was in the back of the truck, it was just me. And a lot of my tubes early on came in those situations. I knew that I was going to be 30, 45 minutes from a hospital, and I didn't have the confidence that I would be able to effectively ventilate someone or manage their airway by my lonesome during that time frame. So I went ahead and went to the far end and intubated them, secured their airway as definitively as I knew how, whether that was necessary or not. Environment plays a role. I work in a fairly urban environment now. I spent the first 10 years of my career in rural EMS, and now I work in a fairly large, well, by Louisiana standards, a fairly large city, where typically I'm no more than 7 or 8 minutes from a hospital anywhere within my response district. A lot of patients I don't need to tube. But by that, and also the organizational culture here at Acadian Ambulance is they actually, you know, surprisingly enough, they give you a little bit of clinical leeway to exercise your clinical judgment, and they don't really force you to make decisions like intubating someone. We're actually encouraged to put that way down the list of our priorities in a resuscitation, as it should be according to the current standards.
What are you guys doing with capnography right now? And are you using that as a tool, a decision tool of whether or not to intubate?
We use waveform capnography on every intubated patient. I think as the protocol states, any patient with an invasive airway, which to my mind, that's great if you want to, if you're using it to as a continuous real-time measure of the effectiveness of your ventilation. If you're using it as a confirmation tool, obviously it's kind of a wasted piece of equipment on a supraglottic airway. But we use waveform capnography on all our intubated patients. We're encouraged to use the nasal capnograph lines to monitor ventilatory effectiveness whenever we feel it's clinically indicated.
That's kind of where I was going, though. I was wondering if you all are using capnography with the nasal waveforms to decide whether or not to intubate ever.
I don't think there's a formally. I don't think there's a policy that actually encourages that we do that. One of our problems is as far as the application of capnography, we have the tools and we have the freedom to use them. We just don't have education-wise at our service. We don't have yet the education to know how to interpret the waveforms. I mean, I know that I do from my own research and informal study on the subject, but you talk to most of my colleagues and they don't know what the different parts of the waveform, and they don't know how to distinguish bronchospasm from a normal waveform and so on and so forth. You know, they probably know what the normal range of entitled CO2 reading should be.
See, that's too bad.
When I use it, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, no. I was just thinking, last time I was in Louisiana, actually, I was going to the EMS Expo right around the time of Katrina. And
yeah,
there
I saw
a great lecture on capnography by a pediatrician who was one of the pediatricians or one of the ear docs that actually learned how to use the thing. There aren't many of those out there.
That's a rare thing indeed. That's one thing where I think it's as far ahead of the ER as far as making effective use of the technology.
Well, what he had done, and I was fascinated by this subject, and he had actually published it, and I need to look that up and start passing it around, was he had come up with a three-stage view of asthma according to capnography, where if you get to the third stage, it's an objective measurement that you must intubate this patient now. And at that point, the entitled CO2 will be about 55 to 60, and the patient will be crashing, but that's easy to see. And of course, with the bronchospasm, you see the shark fin waveform, and a few other things. I was just wondering if you'd ever, if you guys ever try to incorporate that into your stuff.
Not formally. I wish I had seen that lecture. It sounds like something I'd really want to rip off and distribute on my own.
That's a controversial question, Buck. Is in hospital, they typically use entitled CO2s or PaCO2s of 60 in a spontaneously breathing patient, or PaO2s of 60 as a indicator of respiratory failure. Mm-hmm. But in the field, when you're dealing with someone in status asthmaticus, the literature seems to support a more conservative approach unless they're apneic or in imminent risk of cardiac arrest and or respiratory arrest, because likely have to do a rapid sequence intubation, which can be time consuming and somewhat dangerous, especially if you can't secure the airway. And two, you're just dealing with someone who's really on the edge. So although it sounds interesting, was this a guy advocating for actually using those sort of three stages in the pre-hospital setting? Or?
Yes, actually, he was published a work towards that. And what he was going for, just real briefly, I don't want to hijack the whole thing with it. His theory, though, that as you start having an asthma attack, you will start to hyperventilate. And your numbers will actually be low as far as CO2 output, because you'll be winning at that point. As you start to get worse, you'll actually go back through normal. And somebody who's working to maintain respiratory effort will go back through the kind of a normal respiratory effort where you're seeing CO2 output of 40 to 45. As the patient starts to crash, bronchospasm will be actually visibly seen with the shark fin waveform, and you'll see numbers of 60 or higher. And of course, you have to apply that to your patient as well and look at how much you're going downhill. But he was using it as a very objective tool and saying, look, if you're on the fence about whether to intubate your patient and you look over and you're seeing numbers of 60 or higher and you see obvious signs of bronchospasm, then this may be a time to do it. And, of course, in Kentucky, we're so enamored with nasal intubation that we're actually used to nasally intubating breathers, as we call them over here for slang. And there are other parts of the country that do that, too. So there's ways to do this even without RSI.
Hey, Buck.
Yeah.
Buck, one of our listeners, Bill Toon from Johnson County, Kansas,
sure.
Tells us that the doctor's name that you're referring to is Baruch Krause.
Oh, that is him, yeah.
And we put the link in the chat, but I also sent it to you on Skype.
Oh, awesome. Maybe we'll put that in the show notes.
Cavogram shape and obstructive lung disease.
Yeah.
And some other. So that's all available there in the talk shoe.
But me and Rob are kind of getting into a geek fest here and overrunning.
Yeah, I was just gonna say.
You know, it's interesting you would talk about blind nasal intubations that way because, back in the late 80s, 1990s, it seemed like we nasally intubated a lot of patients, especially the CHFers in fulminating pulmonary edema. And now we've just gotten so far away from that with CPAP and with knowledge, as Kelly mentioned earlier, that these patients, unfortunately end up with a longer length of stay in hospital, higher rate of intensive care unit admission, higher rate of more difficult to wean them off the ventilator. So we've kind of steered away from that aggressive approach too. I think the only patients I nasally intubate now are the trauma patients, barring any facial smash.
Yeah.
I listened to a presentation at our state conference several years back. It really drove home the point about CPAP. The chief of the respiratory therapy department at Memorial Hermann Hospital in Houston delivered a lecture on CPAP therapy. And one of the things that Memorial Hermann did in Harris County was they bought a port event CPAP flow generator and two cases of patient circuits for every single ambulance. EMS ambulance in Harris County. That's all the Houston Fire Department and all of the privates that do 911 rollovers. That's a lot of ambulances. There are 300 ambulance services in Harris County alone. But they crunched the numbers on their intubated patients, and they discovered the average stay ICU stay of an intubated patient was anywhere from 7 to 9 days. Yet the Medicare DRG capped out at 5 days, and that's if they had an uncomplicated clinical course. So they were losing money. They were basically providing two days of ICU ventilator care for the vast majority of their patients for free. And now with the Medicare's position, CMS's position on the NEVER events, things like ventilator acquired pneumonia, they're not going to pay for it all.
That's so really changing the course, though, right there.
Yeah, they really started. They started an initiative to start using CPAP on the CHFers and the pulmonary edema patients, and their deal was they would offer the ambulance services, the CPAP flow generators, and whenever they brought in a patient on CPAP, they would replace their patient circuit for free. And they saved, in the neighborhood of $1 million or more per year, even counting the cost of supplying all those flow generators.
Well, CPAP has changed in a lot of stuff like that.
And actually,
we have somebody in the chat room talking about how nasal intubation is barbaric. And you know what? Even though I live in a district where it is very common, I tend to agree with you. That Kentucky is just, like I said, they're enamored with nasal intubation. The doctors love it here. But living in a district where we perform so much nasal intubation, I've learned that in a few circumstances, it's neat to have that skill. Just in a few. I really wish it wasn't used as much as it was in this area. But it is an interesting tool so far as one of the first things that comes to mind is Status Epilepticus, where there's just no way to get in there. And a few other certain circumstances, a neat tool to have in your bag of tricks. But yet, no, I'm even though I talk about it quite often, I don't advocate it near as strongly as my my cohorts over here. But,
hey, Kelly, I want to kind of, if we can get off the nasal intubation thing for a little bit, and just have to
back to snorkeling is so much fun.
Yeah. What are I teaching?
Teaching airway management. Oh yeah, the education part of this. You know, you mentioned the lots of paramedics with 1 year experience that they repeat 20 times. So what do you do to teach airway management to experienced educators? And is there a role in there for or experienced or providers that think they're experienced at least? And then is there a role in there for simulation with mannequins and the high fidelity simulators?
Oh, yes, indeed. I think an airman or a sim man ought to be a piece of required equipment at any EMS education program. I played with Fred the Head, the Laerdal intubation mannequin, for 10 years before I realized that thing actually had a laryngospasm simulator. I didn't realize you could make his cord swell up. When I found that out, I became even more diabolical than I had been in the past. My students hated me for it. But one point was driven home is, they thought they were competent because they could intubate that mannequin, which the bar is set pretty low with Fred the Head. He may be, similar to 75% of the population, but, that 75% of the population is usually not the ones that we're having to intubate in the field. We rarely have to take care of that guy who's got perfect dentition and a grade one Mallampati view, who has an empty stomach and can open his mouth wide open. So one of the things I point out to my students, just with the Fred the Head, that they weren't all that at their intubation skills. And you can set up that sim man where it's virtually impossible to intubate that guy. That's I think convincing providers that they are deficient in their skills, and they're not quite as good. I think you have to kind of upset their self image a little bit, and make them realize that they actually have something to learn. One of the things that's they do at the Texas EMS conferences, they have a pre-conference workshop called SLAM Express. And in Texas, the inventor of this program, James Rich, he's an anesthesiologist from Dallas, he has a proprietary 2- and 3-day airway education workshop called SLAM, Street Level Airway Management. And it's a soup-to-nuts course on airway management, and they basically teach a continuum of care. But the thing that stands out with SLAM is when you have a subject matter expert teaching you, for example, how to insert an LMA or all the ways you can utilize an LMA, it's the inventor of the LMA delivering that lecture and providing that instruction. Same way with the Combitude, same way with the King Airways. He gets the best subject matter experts out there. Plus, there's a pig trach lab and an optional cadaver lab where you actually will intubate a number of cadavers. I think the biggest problem is we think that because we got 6 or 7 tubes in our clinicals, we get 2 or 3 a year, and they're not all that difficult a tube. Our frame of reference is pretty narrow. We haven't really until the time comes when it matters and we fail miserably. It's a shame that we. I'm rambling here. It's a shame that
I can bail you out with a question from our chat room, and I'll just read it. To some degree, it might be a rhetorical question, but it's oral endotracheal intubation is a very rare, complicated skill. Since it's not possible to gain mastery in endotracheal intubation, is it really possible to teach it?
You know what? I would have to disagree with that caller about the mastery issue. I mean, I'm not saying it's possible to achieve mastery in all cases, but I think in my experience, you know, there's always that mannequin versus OR experience, and I'm a firm believer as an educator that patients need that OR experience in their initial training. But beyond that, once they're out working in the field, I think providing them with as much mannequin time is really the key to mastery of that skill, because with, you know, you don't get to see the variety of anatomic, you know, anatomy in a mannequin that you would in regular people. But what you do get is mastery of the steps, mastery of the manipulation of the laryngoscope, for example, into the velacular or underneath the epiglottis, whichever route you take. And so that when, you know, you take that back to the field, at least in my mind, this is my perception, this is not based on any, you know, randomized control studies, it seems to make a major impact in terms of your skill set. So I think once you're in the continuing education phase of your career, I think mannequin intubation, even as Kelly suggested, is incredibly powerful in terms of maintaining that skill and improving proficiency.
And back to how I to Greg's question, how I approach experienced paramedics. Every time I deliver this lecture or talk about airway management to experienced medics, I'll ask things like, you know, how many of you are familiar with Malampati scoring or Cormack and Lehane grading? How many of you know what burp means? Or how many of you are familiar with the lemon law? Or not the car, but the lemon rule. And I would say probably 95% of the experienced paramedics that I talk to have no idea what I'm talking about. It's new information for them. They don't know what they don't know. When I start talking, you know, I throw those things out there and I say, you know, and some of these people work at places where they are allowed to do RSI, which I think is one of the most useful tools in the EMS airway management toolbox, and also potentially the most dangerous one. Because if you approach it thinking that it's going to make it easier to get a tube, then you're already approaching it with the wrong mindset. But these people are basically doing elective endotracheal intubation, yet they don't know how to assess a patient thoroughly for potential complications before they do it. And you can't approach an elective intubation like RSI in the same way that you would approach a crash intubation in your apneic cardiopulmonary arrest patient. You have to approach it from a different mindset.
It's not an either-or kind of thing. I try and tell my students there's a whole spectrum of reasons why you would intubate somebody. There's a whole spectrum of ways to get it done. And exactly. A good provider will not think of intubation as a switch that is turned on and off. It's just a means to an end, and that's why I'm kind of interested in your grades. You know, these six steps. Do you mind running through them really quickly and telling us, you know, what's one and two and three and all that?
Well, the first thing, I preface every statement by saying, you know, I'll ask a question to my audience. So, you know, what is the gold standard of airway management? And most EMS, most paramedics will reply automatically, you know, endotracheal intubation. And I differ on that. I disagree that endotracheal intubation is the gold standard. I think the gold standard in airway management is an outcome, not a device. So the gold standard in airway management should rightfully be considered effective ventilation and management of secretions. If you can do that, no matter what device or procedure you are doing to accomplish that, you're achieving the gold standard. It may be just tilting their head back and using the suction catheter effectively. But when we start with the airway continuum, we start with level one. It generally goes from least invasive and most easily tolerated by the patient all the way to the other end. Level one is positioning and supplemental oxygenation. If you start with one of the things I love in the new PALS videos, if any of you are PALS instructors, in one of the respiratory failure videos, there is a little child there who is stridorous. He's retracting and just looks like he's got horribly ineffective breathing. And the tape asks what one maneuver could eliminate all these problems. And most people will pick a specific airway management device until the video is queued back up, and they come in and they do a head tilt chin lift on this child and watch the stridor disappear, the retractions disappear, everything. People are just conditioned to go beyond where they actually need to. So we start with positioning and supplemental oxygen administration. If you can maximize the patient's respiratory efficiency, you may never need to go to the level where you need to invasively manage their airway. If you have to go beyond that, suctioning and inhaled beta agonist are your next step. And when you talk about suctioning, one of the questions you should ask yourself is not, do I need to protect this patient's airway? Is how far do I need to go, and do I have the resources to protect this patient's airway? Do I have enough patient hands to tilt the patient? Can someone do crack pressure while I suction the patient? These are the factors that influence your decision, and there are a myriad number of factors. But beyond that, you move to oral and nasal airways, and their various benefits and drawbacks. And beyond the oral and nasal airways, the supraglottic airways. And I go through the drawbacks and the benefits of supraglottic airways. I don't know if any of you are familiar with the way Volusia County EMS in Florida has changed the way they look at airway management. Matt Zavadsky, the medical director there, looked at their success rate with endotracheal intubation, and they're an all ALS system. You can't swing a cat and not hit a paramedic on a scene down there. And they discovered that their ALS first responder medics from the fire department had a success rate in endotracheal intubation of 44%.
Ooh.
Now the transport medics were twice as good, 88%, which is still in my view damning with faint praise. They're 88% effective on a first pass. But going from that, it was a non-starter to say, we have far too many paramedics and we have skill rust out. Let's cut back on the number of paramedics. That's politically a non-viable solution. So what they did was they made the Combitube their primary airway of choice in that entire EMS system. If you're going to use an invasive airway, use the Combitube, and only certain medics in that system are allowed to intubate. That was a big step, but it improved outcomes and the comfort level in dealing with airway management and arrest resuscitations. And the medics in that system.
Kelly, how much of it do you think is skills rust out or just lack of skills acquisition, and how much of it is lack of continuing education to maintain those skills?
I think it's a little of both. I mean, one of the things is Greg, when you go to a conference, honestly, how many times have you actually listened to something that was new information?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. I just wrote about this today, actually, that so often you're promised like this education program, new and exciting stuff, and then 90% of it is stuff you've heard before.
Yeah, one prominent EMS blogger that I'm fairly good friends with calls one of the major national conferences EMS last week. But politically incorrect, but and that's no knock on the conference organizers themselves. But when it's a fairly rare thing to go to one of these conferences where a lot of people get their continuing education and actually see new information. And often when you do in-house continuing education, it's a it's a rehash of things that were already taught, and they've been taught the same thing every 2 years and rehashed it. And a lot of times it's not learning anything new. They're rehashing incorrect dogma that's been perpetuated in EMS for however long they've been a paramedic.
I guess I was thinking more of the hands-on continuing education, where they're you know, as you described earlier, they're using SimMan and they're emulating some difficult airways and having the practice to do some hands-on practice.
I believe that, and this is straight out of the simple in concept, difficult in execution files. But I think that there needs, if you're going to allow paramedics to intubate. And I happen to agree with Brian Bledsoe on this, that unless things change in the way we educate and regulate our EMS providers, that within 10 years you're going to see intubation disappear from the paramedic skill set, except for a relatively few very well-trained providers. If we would pull the trigger and do what is necessary to make every paramedic like those well-trained providers that we envision intubating in the future, that's what needs to be done. We need to have a far more stringent requirements for intubation in the initial clinical experience. It needs to be, far more than 6 or 8 or 10 tubes. If it takes an extra 6 months to get those tubes, then so be it. That's a price we're going to have to pay to be taken seriously. And once on the street, if you're not getting, say, X number of tubes, a tube a month, call it 12 a year, if you don't get 12 successful intubations or at least 12 attempts in a 12-month period, there should be a clinical re-education requirement. I'm going to end it up, but let someone else talk. I tend to run off at the mouth, but my employer, Acadian Ambulance, they no longer do this because it was so difficult. We had a huge paramedic shortage, and they were just struggling to put people on the street. So it became an unworkable program. But one of the best things I thought they did was when they hired a medic, didn't matter how long that they had been practicing as a paramedic, didn't matter what kind of experience they had, when you got hired at Acadian Ambulance, you went to an intubation clinical, and they had a couple of anesthesiologists and nurse anesthetists who would precept you, and you got live clinical intubations as a condition of field clearance. You had to go in and demonstrate, 8 successful tubes before they turn you loose on the street. Didn't matter if you were a 20-year paramedic or a 6-month one. I think something like that needs to be reinstituted in just about every EMS system that's going to use endotracheal intubation.
Well, I looked back at the slides you sent for the use of the continuum, and for the law enforcement, the use of force, deadly force is level 6, and I guess for police officers, we'd send them to the firing range to fire off a bunch of rounds, but. I can't imagine the police chief or the commissioners would say, gosh, when we use deadly force, it only works 50% of the time. But look, level 5, which is, say, the taser, that's working 80% of the time. And this was sort of a question that was also in the chat room as well. We could keep sending people to the firing range, but if CPAP is working so well and the King LT or other supraglottic airways are so effective, why are we still throwing training time, training dollars at intubation? Not to mention the patient outcomes. Why do we need level 6 when level 3 and 5 are so good?
I think for the same reason that no one is considering taking firearms away from police officers, because there are situations you are going to deal with, albeit rare. Most cops will go their entire career without ever firing their
right.
Weapon, but there is always the potential to do that. the only way you're going, and you're going to have to, it's not fair to the provider, or to the cops or the people they protect, to deprive them of that means of defense. By the same token, you know, I think it, intubation needs to remain a skill in the airway management toolbox. We just going to have to get more practice at it. How we do that, I don't know. Personally, I think it's to a large extent a matter of will. You know, it's a common misconception that police officers are actually good at marksmanship.
Right.
most cops, the garden variety rank and file police officer fires his weapon a couple times a year, and it's usually the week before weapons qualifications and the weapons qualification course itself. And otherwise, it sits in his holster and may not even get cleaned all that often. And quite frankly, you know, that's most paramedics as well.
Right.
So we need to ask, you know, are we even attracting the right kind of people to EMS? And that's a far bigger can of worms to open. But if the rank and file paramedics don't take this seriously enough to practice it day in and day out, I don't know that we're ever going to get.
I mean, isn't there's sort of the outcome of learning and practicing and teaching the continuum is level of 1 through 5 working so well that there's less and less opportunities to get to level 6. You've got to make some significant organizational a commitment, not just like the individuals, you know, like you said, the police officer analogy. It's not just the individuals. I'm sure there's lots of police officers that would love to go to the firing range and shoot off 100 rounds every Monday morning. But their organization, there's just no way they're buying that much ammunition, not to mention peeing people to go to the firing range once a week. So, you know, the commitment that it's going to take to keep paramedics competent at level 6, while it sounds wonderful, I'm just not sure it's there or it's the best use of our resources. I know Rob has another question before we get out of here. So,
Rob. I really like the analogy that you've drawn between, you know, police and the levels of force that they implement and how we manage airway, because there's so many parallels. You know, we look at less than lethal weapons compared with supraglottic airways, both are sort of continuously improving over time, and we're getting better and better supraglottic airways, or greater varieties of them, like the King LT and the Salt Airway, and I think we're going to see an increase in use of those, especially at the lower levels of EMS care. But you know, something you mentioned earlier kind of tweaked my interest when you talked about lemon and melon patty and stuff like that, and you know. In the early days, I really had trouble with the melon patty concept because, you know, assessing melon patty is something anesthetists do in awake patients before they go into the OR, and they, you know, take their time asking them to open their mouth. And I was thinking the exact same thing. Even though I was teaching it, even though I was teaching it, I was having trouble sort of appreciating its relevance other than to, you know, explain to the students, well, you know, get to know this because this is what you'll do in the OR. But what really struck home with me is with a lemon approach is the second step. Well, the first step, L, you know, looking for things
external,
like small mandible, large tongue, short neck, that kind of thing. The second piece, evaluate the 3-3-2 rule, that you know, three fingers for the hyomental distance, mm-hmm. and not so much the three fingers in the mouth, but the other, you know, two from the mandible to the thyroid cartilage. And when I started looking at that and thinking about that, you know, I started looking at people when I'm walking around differently, because you know how as paramedics we look at
people's veins. Hey, great veins, yeah.
Because now I look at the hyomental distance and I think, wow, that guy's got a really tiny chin, you know, and so it really struck me that, you know, this is a good way to teach paramedics to appreciate the anticipate the difficult airways was that one step.
You know, and the thing is it's my belief that the two biggest run home to mama diagnoses in EMS are atrial fib. If it's got a trashy looking isoelectric line and it's semi irregular, most people are going to call it atrial fib and not look any harder. And the other one is I didn't get the tube because the guy was really anterior. you know, but yeah.
The third one was I was up against a valve.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, that's a good one.
I haven't been up against a valve in about 5 years. That's what I tell people when I do that.
That's the unholy. That's the unholy trinity of EMS. But you tell people the people that will tell you, well, you know, it had a really anterior glottic opening. Mention hyomental distance, and they will look at you like a deer in the headlights. They have no idea what you're talking about the vast majority of the time. And you know, I had an ER physician say, man, he's really anterior. I can't see anything. And I laid three fingers. You know, I could lay all four of my fingers across the knuckle between his thyroid cartilage and his chin. Said, yeah, he's really anterior, all right. I could fall down and accidentally intubate that guy.
Downstairs, even.
Yeah. Never run with them. The other day, I was checking out my equipment and stumbled and accidentally intubated my partner. Never run with an open laryngoscope, boys and girls.
You know, I had a guy installing my cable one day, and he had this holster full of tools. And I remember he pulled out these wire cutters and spun them around in his fingers like a gun in the Old West, and then clamped the wire and stripped the cover off of it, and then spun it around his finger again and put it back into his holster. And I always wanted to master that with a laryngoscope handle and blade.
Yeah, you know, when you talk about tools, in a nutshell synopsis of the way our minds work in EMS and the way our minds should work. We're all about the tools and the procedures and the things that we actually do. There's the story of the NASA launch that was delayed because of an electrical problem. They called an electrician in, and he poked around and he looked around and he tightened one screw and fixed the problem. And he charged them $5,000. And he said, $5,000 for turning one screw? I mean, all you did was turn a screw. And he said, okay, it was $4,900. $1 for turning the screw. It was $49.99 for knowing which screw to turn. And that's the, you know, we need to, the way we approach patient care in general needs to be, in my mind, needs to get a little more cerebral and a little less psychomotor. Not to say that psychomotor skills are unimportant. We're always going to have the need for that, but we're going to have to be more discerning about how we apply those skills. The only way to do that is more education.
All right. Well, I tell you what, we're getting close to our hour here, as we like to keep it about an hour or so. Well, although this has been a great conversation. But, Mr. Grace, we'd like to thank you for coming out.
Thank you.
And sharing your wisdom with us. I like this system. I got to get on your website now and poke around at that. KellyGrayson.com, am I correct?
Yes, KellyGrayson.com. And here comes the shameless personal plug.
I was going to tell you to do that. Go ahead. All your social media stuff.
The blog is called A Day in the Life of an Ambulance Driver. And the book is called En Route, Stories of Paramedic Stories of Life, Death, and Everything in Between. Available at booksellers near you.
Awesome. I imagine it's on Amazon.com if we look at
it.
Oh, we'll try and put that in the show notes for you. And cool. Any other social media stuff? Are you on Twitter or Facebook?
I'm on Facebook. I really can't deal with I don't know that I actually have anything to say on Twitter.
Spending the last hour with you, I think you're a top candidate for Twitter.
Yeah, well, I don't know. But you've also listened to me. Did I keep anything I say less than 140 characters?
I think it'd be good discipline for you.
Oh, okay.
See, Twitter's for the zingy one-liners. See, that's where you got to go.
See,
Think about
Brevity is the soul of shit that I am a witless dude.
Well, Kelly, you are the master of one-liners. I've heard some great ones tonight. So I'm kind of with Greg. I think you need to Twitter, even though I'm not Twittering.
I'll get that some.
All right. Well, thank you, Kelly. And Greg Freese, where can we go through like 8 or 10 of the ways we can find you for?
You know, tonight I just want to give a shout out to everydayemstips.com, a place for students, EMTs, paramedics. See blog posts I write. I have some great guest contributors, including you, Buck, that helped me out there. Cool. Some fun stuff going on, and welcome any of you to check it out.
Cool. Hey, we should maybe we should mention our future project that we're working on over there. Greg and I are working on a series of pharmacology tips that are going to come out.
This is bold to pronounce this to the public.
We're going to do this.
We're going to do it. But we're like in the early idea stage. So
I'm about ready to go.
Are we talking about recreational pharmaceuticals or something else?
Well, if it's recreational pharmaceuticals, there's a guy right across from my ambulance station that will hook you up.
No thanks. So good. Buck and I are committed now. I like it. Good.
Oh, putting it out there. And Rob, tell us where we can get a hold of you, buddy.
You can find me on my blog, which is paramedictutor.wordpress.com. And I hate to make these gratuitous plugs, but I just want to plug Paramedicine 2009, which is a conference being held in Mississauga, which is just west of Toronto. And we'd love to see some of our American colleagues come visit us. Paramedicine 2009 is November 20th and 22nd. The website is www.paramedicine.ca. And we have none other than Steve Barry as our keynote speaker for this year's conference.
Cool. All right. And I guess I should jump on the shameless link bandwagon. you can get me at on Twitter at Buckman, if you have not found me before. Check me out at copycode3.com. That show is going to start ramping up here in the next week or two. We're going to provide you with some new episodes. And also Strange Little Blog, Gomerville.com, which is exactly the way I want it to be right now. I'm actually starting to put new posts up there. There's one about pancakes. It's not always about EMS. And the soon-to-come post, there is Advanced Super Manly Pancakes. So be looking for that. But as always, the EMS Educast, which is exactly the way I want it. I have had a blast tonight. Although we got super nerdy there for a minute and kind of came off the rails, but as always, Greg Freese put us back on. But I love this chat room. There's about 10 people answering, you know, throwing out some good questions out there, some really good fans. And this is what I wanted. This is what I wanted the Educast to be. This is really fun. I got a lot of audience feedback. Got good guests, good friends. And we're going to keep doing this. Whether or not it's on TalkShoe, I don't know. But TalkShoe is pretty cool. But it gets kind of buggy, and I'm sorry if anybody got kicked off tonight, but that does happen. I apologize. But we will be broadcasting live every Wednesday night at 8 Central, 9 Eastern Standard Time. And you're welcome to come by. Cost nothing. Throw us questions, and we'll pass them on. But thank you so much, Mr. Grayson, for coming out.
Thank you guys for having me.
Yeah, and we'll have you back. We'll look on this, and we often return to guests, and this has been a lot of fun tonight. But thank you. We return again next week. Greg, what are we doing?
Next week, John Dillon, paramedic, police officer, graphic artist extraordinaire, and also he designs electronic games for teaching. He's our guest. Excited to have him. You know, small chance we might come up with something even more interactive than TalkShoe. John and I have a couple things up our sleeves.
Oh.
So.
All right.
Let's wrap this up.
Cool. I think we should get Bob Dylan. You used to intubate. Now the only thing you do is hesitate.
Oh, we're going to leave it there. We're going to end it. Anyway, thank you all, and we'll see you next week. Good night. Thank you for joining us tonight. The EMS Educast is proud to be part of the ProMed Network of podcasts, which can be found at www.promednetwork.com. Be sure to check out all the other wonderful podcasts that can be found there. And don't forget to join us live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Central and 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time at emseducast.com/live. Follow the link to listen live and chat with our guests. See you there.